From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration can no longer use a public health emergency to justify deporting migrant children who cross the border, the U.S. border, alone. That's the ruling of a federal judge in Washington, D.C., who struck down a policy from the CDC that the White House had argued would prevent migrants from spreading the coronavirus in immigration detention. But the judge wrote in his ruling that the government overstepped its authority in trying to undo immigration laws passed by Congress. Lee Gelernt is an attorney with the ACLU, one of the organizations who sued the administration. And Lee, what's your reaction to this ruling?
We're ecstatic, you know, for these children who are fleeing danger, coming here all by themselves, and had been routinely expelled by the Trump administration. This was a cruel policy, not unlike other Trump administration policies directed at migrant children. It was also unnecessary. We've always viewed it as a pretext. The medical professionals had all said, you can bring these children in, test them as needed, quarantine them as needed, but you don't expel them. And I think recent reporting has shown that CDC did not want this policy in place, that they were overridden by the White House. So we are thrilled. We hope that the administration will not appeal it, but we're not holding our breath given how the Trump administration has been acting in the immigration area for the past 4 years.
Well, I want to ask you more about that. I mean, unaccompanied children would normally be placed in shelters. How many children have been expelled since the rules went into effect back in March at the start of this pandemic? And what happened to them in Mexico?
So the amazing thing is that the administration is not actually even providing numbers of children who have been expelled under this policy. We know from reporting and leaked sources that it's over 13,000, and that was as of a month ago. So we expect that the number, when we finally get a new number, will be over 14,000, possibly 15,000, who knows, but thousands and thousands of children. And they're expelled to Mexico if they're Mexican, and if they're not Mexican, they are put on a plane to whatever country they came from, usually Central America. They were being hidden in hotels on the border, sometimes detention centers. The policy was largely in secret, and then they were just put on a plane without an asylum hearing, and children as young as 10 years old.
Thousands of children, some as young as 10 years old. But these expulsions weren't limited to just children. Are expulsions of other immigrants continuing, and is that legal?
So that's absolutely right. We believe that over 200,000 adults and families have also been expelled pursuant to this policy. This particular case involved only unaccompanied minors. We hope the Trump administration will get rid of the policy, but obviously we are evaluating next steps in the litigation because we're acutely aware that many adults and families are being harmed by the policy as well.
And, you know, we've been talking for several months about family separation. Is that still happening at the border under the Trump administration?
So the family separation tragedy is still ongoing, but there are very few continuing separations. But the reason for that is because of this Title 42 policy. No one's even being allowed in the country, so therefore they're not being separated. The real issue now with family separation is that we still haven't found hundreds and hundreds of families who were separated in the beginning of the Trump administration. We are searching for them. And we would like to see the Biden administration do four things in particular with family separation. When they come in, we would like to see them allow parents who have been separated for years and are in Central America to rejoin their children in the United States. We'd like to see all the families separated by the Trump administration given some form of legal status, given what they've been through. What I think many people don't know is that the Trump administration right now is trying to deport all of these families who were previously separated. The third point is we'd like to see some kind of fund created to help the families with medical needs, but beyond medical needs. And finally, going forward, we want to make sure that separations do not occur unless a child welfare expert signs off on it. There's judicial oversight. But the immediate thing is to provide relief for the families who have previously been separated.
Lee, immigration is very much a partisan issue. I mean, these four asks of the Biden administration, sound really ambitious. Have you gotten any indication from the incoming Biden administration that they would take on any of these four asks from you?
So all we know at this point is that Vice President Biden has said this is an issue he is very concerned about and is going to create a task force. We haven't got to specifics. I think there's just some things we don't do in the United States, and one is making children pawns to score political points.
League Alert is a civil rights lawyer with the ACLU. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
More than a quarter of a million Americans have now died in the coronavirus pandemic. And according to the latest figures from Johns Hopkins University, more than 1.5 million Americans have been getting tested for the virus every day. Testing has risen steadily over recent months, but health officials say it's still far from adequate. Kerry Goldberg from member station WBUR brings us inside one biotech company scrambling to process the latest avalanche of tests.
In a brightly lit room about the size of a high school gymnasium, workers are assembling and testing rows of machines and robots along gray metal tracks.
So you see these little like train cars that are moving along. It's sort of like a grown-up train set.
Jason Kelly is the CEO of Ginkgo Bioworks, a big biotech startup based in downtown Boston.
And what they're able to do is move little plates, laboratory plates, that would have a bunch of different test samples in the plate. And it can move them anywhere through the facility. You see the tracks running through there. It was about an 18,000 square foot box we're standing in here.
A box that's designed to process tens of thousands of coronavirus tests a day at a time when there are growing calls for much more testing. Every few feet, a lime green robot arm towers above the gray rails. The arm's pincers can pick the plate up and move it onto a piece of lab equipment.
Then the equipment can run, and in this case, what it would be doing is running COVID-19 diagnostic tests to see is this a positive or a negative sample.
Kelly hopes the Ginkgo testing facility will be up and running by early December.
In the context of sort of reopening society for like workplaces and schools, you need so much more of it than we're doing today that you absolutely have to start deploying new technologies like this if we're going to make it cheap enough before we all have a widespread vaccine to really get the virus under control.
Ginkgo Bioworks won a $40 million federal grant to repurpose top-of-the-line DNA analysis machines, what's called next-generation sequencing, for coronavirus testing. It's part of a federal project called RADx that's spending nearly $500 million with the goal of adding 1 million more tests a day to the country's capacity by early next year. The company is also piloting a workplace testing program using saliva tests. Ginkgo's Rob Morfino is working on that program.
So everything is designed to be quick, but also convenient. So we really want people to have testing as part of their daily routine.
Many people who've gotten tested in recent months would not call it quick or convenient or pleasant if it involved a deep nasal swab. But the Ginkgo Bioworks effort is part of the growing push toward a new phase of testing that includes shallower swabs and far more screening of people without symptoms. Dr. Thomas Tsai, a testing policy expert at Harvard and Brown University, says he's seen remarkable strides on improving technical aspects of testing in recent months.
Our efficiency of our testing through newer technologies such as next-generation sequencing, these are things that we were talking about as coming down the pipeline, but that future is now, is here. So these technologies are present.
The challenge, Tsai says, is that most tech innovations focus mainly on what happens in the laboratory, speeding up the time it takes to process tests.
But there are multiple bottlenecks we have to consider, and if we are to truly improve our testing strategy, we have to break through all of those bottlenecks.
They include ferrying tests quickly to processing sites like the one Ginkgo Bioworks is setting up, and getting results back to people quickly, and persuading lots of people without symptoms to take the tests. Also, the cost and availability of tests where they're needed most.
Those are not technological questions. Those are complex, questions around policy goals and public health.
The technological side is plenty complex as well. Jason Kelly at Ginkgo Bioworks says getting all the elements of this huge robotic testing system to work together is not trivial. But Ginkgo is known for large-scale automation of life science lab work. It's what's known as a unicorn, a startup valued at more than $1 billion, in this case over $4 billion. And Kelly says the company is pitting its technical heft against the coronavirus.
Like, this is basically the biological event of our lives, you know, right? It would be like, imagine this whole thing that was like tearing the world apart was like a computer virus. Would Google like sit it out?
The company is one of dozens working on new testing technologies, and Kelly predicts more rapid progress. Plus, when the pandemic is over, he says, the Ginkgo Bioworks testing machines can be reused for the company's more typical work, like engineering new treatments for genetic diseases. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
The 1980s were good to Michael J. Fox. The actor shot to fame with roles in the sitcom Family Ties and the Back to the Future films.
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
But in 1991, at the age of 29, Fox was diagnosed with early-onset Parkinson's disease. In 2000, he founded the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. The organization has raised $1 billion to find a cure. Through it all, Fox found a way to maintain his signature optimism. Until 2018, when his sunny disposition took a significant hit, Fox underwent spinal surgery, and then a serious fall that forced him to confront his mortality. He writes about that year in his new book, No Time Like the Future, which is out this week. And Michael J. Fox joins me now. Welcome.
My pleasure to be here.
And tell me about that fall.
Well, I had had an eventful year up to that point. I was dealing with my 30th year with Parkinson's. So that kind of I had a handle on. Then I had a spinal tumor. And I had surgery on that. And it took me a while to learn how to walk again. And I barely learned to walk again when I, of course, declared independence. And told everybody I could walk on my own and I could be alone. And so the first time I was alone in the apartment, I got up, walked into the kitchen, slipped on the floor and shattered my arm. And of all the indignities, that was for some reason the cutting blow.
Yeah. So you, as you say, you were dealing not only with Parkinson's for many years, you'd just gone through this incredibly dangerous surgery to remove a tumor from your spine. Just to spend a moment there for a minute. How serious was that spinal diagnosis?
It was pretty serious. It had been with me for quite a while, for a few years, but it had been kind of benign and static and wasn't doing anything. And I kind of got, from the doctors, I got to just watch that and check on it every now and then. So one of the last times I checked on it, it had in fact grown quite considerably and was actually on the spinal cord itself, which then made it something that most surgeons didn't want to touch because they can't in any way touch the spinal cord. So how do you remove something from the spinal cord when you can't touch it? But a doctor, Johns Hopkins, Dr. Theodore went through it with me and discussed the risks. And the risks of not doing it were that I would be paralyzed by now. By the time we speak, from when it was put to me that way, I would be paralyzed by now.
Yeah. And there you are lying on the floor in your apartment in New York City, your arm shattered. You'd gone through all of these challenges and gotten through them for the most part, right? So where do you think the darkness came from? Why did you so desperately lose that optimism that you become known for?
Just for some reason, it was almost instantaneous. This was the last lemon that I was no longer going to make lemonade. I just said, this is unbelievable. And I was angry at myself for taking for granted the attention and the care that everyone put into my health and my life and, you know, my family that had been asking me to be careful. And I said, don't, I'm being careful. And then I carelessly, because I was walking too fast and I was too kind of full of pride at my achievements to understand the risk I was taking and that it put all the work the doctors had done at risk and then put all the time and attention that the physical therapist had put into me at risk. And I just thought, I was angry at myself on that level. And then I further got angry, as I said, about this, how's I going to put a shine on this? What kind of catchy phrase did I have to lay on myself to get me past this? There was nothing. It was just like, and then I started to think with the Parkinson's community, had I offered up optimism as a panacea, had I, you know, kind of said, chin up, it'll be okay. And really, there are people that had on the misery index a lot higher needle than me lying on the floor with a broken arm and a bad back. And Parkinson's disease, there are people who have lost lives, homes, country, family, children. What about them? Who am I to tell them to be optimistic? I'm lying on the floor like a rag.
Oh, and I can see why you would be angry, but what about scared?
Yeah, I was scared too. Well, that what happened was when I came out of that period, that come off the floor and had my arm fixed and went through a period of reflection. And I examined all these things, fear, aging, gratitude, just all these things came through my mind. And as I made notes on them, for no reason other than just, I believe when you're going through something, it's worthwhile to take contemporaneous notes. And as I look back at these notes I made, I said, let's stitch these together into the story of what happened and how I lost and regained my optimism, and how my new optimism is kind of a little more informed and a little more realistic. You can be a realist and an optimist at the same time.
You reminded us, for those who need to be reminded, how precious a thing it is to walk. And I found the way that you described your relationship with wheelchairs to be very powerful. At one point in the book, you said that unless you know the person who's pushing you, it can be a very isolating experience. In fact, you compared yourself to a piece of luggage. And then you went on to say that if we could ever just look at each other in the eye, we would recognize our shared humanity. And I just want to thank you for that, because actually, I had never thought of that before. And those are probably things I imagine that you took for granted at some stage in your life.
Absolutely. It's even when you're used to being, and I talk at great length in the book about what movement meant to me for my life, and how I was always moving, whether it was in my job as an actor, having to do stunts or having to do physical representations of what was happening, or as an athlete, not a good one, but a persistent one. And so when I looked at things like wheelchairs, it was a dual thing. One, to have been an able-bodied person my whole life, and then to be in a position where I can't walk. And then the other thing about being in the chair is that, for me personally, I'm someone who is easily recognizable and everybody knows and tends to be familiar with, and even if they don't know me, and that's a great privilege of what I do. But when you're in a chair, you're just a piece of luggage. And if the guy pushing you, if you're at an airport or a hotel or something, he's just getting you from point A to point B and hoping he gets $5 for it. And so you're just this thing, and you get pushed out of the elevator, and you're facing the wall. You can't get anyone's attention other than verbally. You can't give a little nod because no one's looking. It's funny. Wheelchairs being as open as they are, they might as well have bubbles over them, smoke glass bubbles, because people can be quite anonymous in them.
Well, let's talk about your acting career, the thing that made it so that people recognize you on the street. You've gotten roles in recent years that didn't hide the fact that you had Parkinson's symptoms, but actually incorporated that into the role, such as Lewis Canning, who, of course, is the lawyer on the TV drama The Good Wife. Let's listen to a scene there.
I suffer from a condition, tardive dyskinesia, which is really, this is a funny word for a neurological disorder, and it makes me do this and this and if you just look at me long enough, you get used to it. So feel free to look, and I won't mind.
In the book, you say that you're ready to accept that your acting career is over.
To a certain extent, I allow for the fact that something could surprise me or something could change. But the last couple times I acted, I took roles, and I happened to play lawyers again. And anyway, I had difficulty memorizing my lines. I had difficulty, for some reason, and that had always been something that had been just a given with me. I'd look at a Family Ties script and for 5 minutes, and I'd know the whole show. And I just always had that kind of photographic memory. So to get in a position where I didn't, I was struggling with the lines and was in the position of like Leo DiCaprio and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, just going off the set saying, what is the deal? But unlike him in that movie, who was berating himself and really angry, when I found myself in that position, I said, oh, okay, well, this isn't working, so maybe we'll find some other way to do it, or not do it at all.
Well, you also say you may be done with golf, another thing that you've loved. How is it letting these things go, or acknowledging that it might be time soon to let them go?
It's all about acceptance, and as I say in the book, gratitude. And the acceptance part of it is, whatever something is, if you accept it and just say, okay, that is what it is, I can deal with that. And by accepting it, it doesn't mean you can't endeavor to change it. But if you don't accept it for what it is, then it's going to be this amorphous blob that seeps through every cranny of your life, and you never feel settled, you never feel adjusted. So I accept that, the fact that if I swing the golf club too hard, I fall down. And then it's not like, boo-hoo, I'm falling down. It's like, I'm falling down. And then, therefore, I don't put myself in that position again to fall down. But maybe one day I'll be treated in a way, or find some way to get so I don't fall down, and then I'll golf again, and I'll be grateful for it. It's just a matter of, it's not compartmentalizing, really. It's just taking inventory and seeing where that thing fits in the inventory of your life. And so the losses that I've had are more than compensated for by my family, by my friends, by the role I have in the Parkinson's community to affect change, to the relationships I have with people on the street, to how much I enjoy reading, how much I enjoy film, how much I enjoy writing. There's lots to fill your life.
I'm speaking with Michael J. Fox, whose new book is called No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. And Michael, someone listening to this may have just been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and that could be very frightening for them, as you well know. In fact, you become an ambassador of sorts for folks with Parkinson's. What's your message to people who've just recently been diagnosed?
Well, I was talking to a man the other day who said that he had a nephew who was just diagnosed, and like me, was diagnosed at the age of 29. I was 29 when I was diagnosed. That was 29 years ago. So I said, for you being diagnosed at 29 means for sure, no doubt, bank on it, bet on it, write it down. There will be a cure in your lifetime.
And how much credit can the Fox Foundation take for that?
We'll take none. We'll just be happy it happened. We are the largest funder of Parkinson's research in the private sector. But it was never our mission. You know, our mission is just, we have a thing when we first started, we talked about how to structure a foundation. Someone brought up endowment. So I said, endowment, like you get a pile of money you sit on? And they said, yeah. I said, we won't be doing that. The money will come in and it'll go out. And so that's the model we've operated on then. And the other thing we've always said is purity of motive. Whatever you do, it's if your motive is pure, that you're just trying to get this work done as quickly as we can for people. And that's the way it's been. So yeah, optimism is a driver in almost everything I do, because there's no sense in doing something if you can't at least argue for a positive outcome.
Michael J. Fox, thank you so much. Be well.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12. The first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
President Trump's latest nominee to the Federal Reserve Board, Judy Shelton, is in limbo after the Senate refused to approve her this week. And although some Republicans are hoping to get another chance to advance her nomination to the central bank, time is running out. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. And Mike, Shelton's candidacy has stalled for about a year and a half because she faces opposition on both sides of the aisle. Why has it taken so long for the Senate to get to this point?
Well, Tanya, the main issue is she's just a very controversial nomination due to her past views that are sort of way out of the mainstream of economic thinking. And also because her opinions seem to really change to align herself with President Trump when he came into office, to sort of back up the things that Trump wanted out of the Fed. So the Republican leadership in the Senate really had a tough time building the support that they would need to pass her through the Senate. There are actually three Republican senators, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, and Lamar Alexander, who oppose her. And there are also two other Republicans, Chuck Grassley and Rick Scott, who are in quarantine for the virus right now. So even if they were able to sort of drum up a tie and have Mike Pence vote to break the tie, with those two senators out on quarantine, they just don't have the votes to even get to a tie that the vice president could break.
And talking about some of her controversial views, she's faced criticism for her view that the value of the dollar should be tied to gold. The U.S. really has essentially not been on the gold standard for almost 100 years. Is it unusual for a president to nominate someone with views that are so outside of the mainstream?
Absolutely, especially to get them this far. President Trump did sort of push the envelope, so to speak, in this realm by discussing appointing both Herman Cain and Stephen Moore to the Fed earlier in his term. Both of them never made it this far where there was actually the potential to be voted on. So this is likely the most controversial nominee to make it this far in the process that we've seen in a long time.
You laid out really well for us the chances of her being approved and the stacks against her. But if she were approved, she'd be on the board through 2024. What impact would she likely have on the Fed's role in navigating a recovery from the pandemic?
Right. So there are seven members of the Federal Reserve Board. All seven of them are part of the 12-member Open Market Committee, which is what we sort of think about when people reference the Fed, because that's the committee that sets interest rates and other policies that sort of directly affect the markets and the economy. So she gets just one vote. So that means she doesn't have a huge pull on that policy. But I think what the critics are getting at is that she'd sort of be a distraction and a bad influence on the whole process. And there's also a concern about just opening that window, opening that door towards purely politically motivated members of the Fed, which I think politicians on both sides of the aisle want to avoid that because they, you know, it's just a dangerous precedent to set to sort of have these very politically loyal members of the Federal Reserve actually get onto the board like that.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. As we heard earlier in the program, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from deporting unaccompanied migrant children under a public health emergency order. One of the architects of that policy is senior White House advisor Stephen Miller, who has been behind many of the administration's controversial immigration policies. With a new administration coming, Miller will soon lose his prominent role in the White House, but our next guest argues he will still have a lasting impact. Gene Guerrero is the author of Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. And Gene, you argue that it is impossible to truly understand the Trump era without first tracing Miller's ascension to the role as Trump's senior advisor. Say more.
Exactly. You know, I had been reporting out of the busiest border crossing in the United States, and I kept hearing this narrative out of the White House that, you know, that the family separation policy and all of their other immigration policies were about law and order, that they were just trying to keep Americans safe. But I knew from my experience reporting on the ground that that was not the case, that they were primarily targeting families who were breaking no laws. So I felt that if I really wanted to understand the intentions behind the immigration policies, I was going to have to look at the person who was shaping the policies, and that person being Stephen Miller, and understanding what motivates him.
Understanding what motivates Stephen Miller, and in your book, you actually draw a through line between Miller's upbringing in liberal blue state California, where he grew up in Santa Monica, and his conservatism, which began in middle and high school. Who and what were his influences?
Exactly. You know, Stephen Miller is truly a product of the California of the 90s. Today, most people think of California as this very blue state, kind of leading the charge against Trumpism in many ways. But back then, there was a lot of anti-immigrant hostility and a real resurgence of white supremacy that is sort of a microcosm for what we're seeing nationally today. You know, the governor, Pete Wilson, was blaming all of the state's fiscal and crime problems on immigrant families. There were advertisements running on television that showed families crossing the border and an ominous narrator's voice saying, "They keep coming." And so Stephen Miller was internalizing this rhetoric and, you know, acting it out in his very diverse public high school. He would go around telling his Mexican classmates to speak English, to go back to their countries. He would go into school board meetings to argue passionately against measures to improve racial equity. And what I found through my reporting for the book is that during this time period in his life is when a man named David Horowitz came into Stephen Miller's life and became almost like a father figure to him. You know, Horowitz is a former Marxist turned right-wing radical who believes that everything that we hold dear in American society is a result of white men. It's a completely ahistorical idea that ignores the central role of people of color in this country's history, but these are ideas that appealed to Stephen Miller. It gave him a framework to understand a feeling of displacement that he was undergoing at that time period. And, you know, he gave him the tools to fight multiculturalism, which he came to perceive as an existential threat.
And what's interesting, what you're saying here is he learned the tools to fight multiculturalism, but in many ways using some of the same tactics that those in the civil rights movement used to really call attention to discrimination and segregation regarding people of color.
Exactly. Because David Horowitz came from the radical left and joined the radical right, he taught men like Stephen Miller the weapons of the civil rights movement to attack civil rights. So, for example, casting white conservative men as victims of discrimination based on their skin color, using terms like racist or oppressor to describe communities of color. Completely inverting and deflecting the language of the civil rights movement and of the left.
Last year, former Breitbart editor Katie McHugh shared emails from Stephen Miller showing his belief and endorsement of white supremacy. And you actually met with her in the course of writing this book. What did she help you understand in piecing all of this together?
You know, she tells me that he helped to radicalize her at a young age when she was feeling vulnerable and when she was feeling displaced by pumping her full of, you know, information from these websites that falsely depicted people of color as somehow innately more violent than white people. You know, the use of false crime statistics about black people and about immigrants are a very common white supremacist recruiting tactic. And this is something that Stephen Miller used with Katie and led to her radicalization, where she began to espouse very racist beliefs. And it wasn't until she realized that this movement was, you know, ultimately going to lead to acts of mass violence that she decided to separate and try to atone for some of her behavior by sharing these emails with Stephen Miller.
Miller never agrees to an interview with you, but you do talk with several people he grew up with and some people in his close circle. But others, mostly in Trump's camp, have pushed back against your assertions. You've actually said that Steve Bannon has called you an insane hater. What has been the reaction and response to your book, and why is it important now?
Well, I mean, so the reaction has been a recognition, and I think an increased willingness among, you know, our nation's storytellers, our nation's journalists, to call white nationalism by its name. I think there's been a real reluctance, you know, from day one of the Trump administration to call the agenda what it is, which is a white nationalist agenda. I didn't write this book to tell readers that Stephen Miller has hate in his heart. But what I can tell you is that he is fluent in hate, and he deliberately uses the language of hate and reaches out to communities to try to incite hatred. You know, based on strategy papers that I reviewed that talk about the political utility of hatred, this is not an inaccurate way to describe what the administration is doing. Stephen Miller has used hate mongering to divide Americans and to rally people around an agenda that is pulled directly from think tanks funded by white supremacists who believe in population control for non-white people.
You know, we're having this conversation right now as we're entering a new year and a new administration. But you've noted that one of Stephen Miller's lasting influences will be how he has changed the way the Department of Homeland Security functions domestically. In what ways?
Exactly. You know, one of the most surprising things about reporting the story of Stephen Miller's life was the realization that this is so much bigger than the immigration issue or even issues related to racial and social justice. Because, you know, Stephen Miller is essentially a public relations flack who, at the age of 31, without any policy experience, was put in charge of the Department of Homeland Security, which is supposed to protect Americans from everything from, you know, domestic terrorism to cyber warfare to things like pandemics. And he, from day one, narrowed the focus of the department to target communities of color, so and specifically immigrant families. And Homeland Security experts who I spoke to for the book tell me that this left Americans more vulnerable to a range of real threats like the pandemic and, you know, like white supremacist extremists who are currently on the rise.
What do you think is next for him?
Well, if Trump had won re-election, his plan was to try to eliminate birthright citizenship. You know, in our Constitution, it says that if you are born in the United States, you are automatically a citizen of this country. And Stephen Miller, you know, and Trump had deemed this to be too politically risky ahead of the 2020 elections, and they were hoping to implement it during a second term. So I believe that, you know, once they leave the White House, as they're supposed to do, that Stephen Miller will continue to pursue paths to reduce and restrict the access to legal immigration. And I think, you know, Stephen Miller, from the time he was a teenager, has been really skilled at using media. And I think that this is a tactic that he's going to continue to use to radicalize people and to instill hatred in their hearts towards communities of color.
That's reporter and author Jean Guerrero. Jean, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
In California, companies like Uber and Lyft spent a fortune passing Proposition 22, a ballot measure aimed at changing labor laws for gig workers. Now, those companies are starting to lobby for similar changes in other states. But critics say that California's new law is a step back from existing worker protections. LA Times business reporter Suhana Hussain is tracking this story. Suhana, welcome.
It's great to be here.
And we've had some time now to process the impact of this election. So what's the sense there in California about how wide-ranging the impact will be of passing Prop 22?
I think, obviously, it's a huge deal with major implications not only for California, but for the gig economy in the United States as well, because the companies like Uber and Lyft have indicated that they are hoping to now take this model to other states and potentially to the federal level as well.
And let's talk about what changed. I mean, what's the biggest change now that this law is going into effect?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the biggest change is that workers for these gig companies, you know, so drivers for Uber and Lyft and like delivery workers for companies like Instacart and DoorDash, they will be classified as independent contractors. There had been kind of a fight in the state of California over how to classify these workers. And what that means is those workers will not have access to the suite of benefits that come with employment status in the state. But the measure does offer some benefits. So workers will newly have access to those when the law goes into effect in mid-December.
Right. Companies argued that it would pay drivers a higher wage, for one, would offer them some money or a stipend for health benefits. But some critics of Prop 22 are saying that was misleading, right? What are you hearing?
So broadly, the law requires that companies provide an hourly minimum wage for time spent on rides equal to 120% of either the local or statewide minimum wage. It also gives workers driving at least 15 hours a week, like stipend for health insurance coverage, and a larger one for those putting in 25 hours a week. The important thing to note about these two benefits, though, is that it applies to drivers' active time, so it doesn't count the time that a driver would spend, like, waiting around for a ride. It's only the time that they spend, like, going to pick up someone or when they have someone in the car. So critics have pointed out it's objectively weaker than what the state minimum wage is for employees and that sort of thing.
Mm. You know, the PR machine was in full effect on this proposition. Companies like Uber and Lyft spent a lot of money trying to get Prop 22 passed. But do you think it's kind of surprising that it did pass in California? I mean, this is a place where liberal policies in support of workers might actually be expected to thrive, you know, not policies that would favor big corporations.
I think it was a surprise for a lot of people, not only because California is the labor-friendly state, but also just because it's hard to get ballot initiatives passed. You know, it is pretty surprising, and I think a lot of people were, you know, shocked. But at the same time, this campaign was saturating, like, the airwaves, TV, you know, social media. They were really putting out their message, and pretty much everyone has those apps, and they were also pushing that message to the apps.
Are you saying that when, like, if I opened up my Uber app on my phone, that like I would get an ad from Uber telling me to support Prop 22?
Especially in the weeks ahead of the election, people, users in California were getting those. Yeah.
Constantly. So that's a captive audience. You know, what are you hearing from drivers and other gig workers now that they're preparing for this law to go into effect in December? You know, I'm sure their opinions run the gamut. What are you hearing?
Yeah. You know, ahead of the election, I was hearing from drivers on both sides. Like, I think there were drivers who felt very strongly that they didn't want to be classified as employees, and also those who did, because they don't feel like they have enough benefits and protections, and they were sort of at the whims of these major corporations. But I think there are also people in the middle of that who both felt like employee status was not the answer, but also were worried at like how these companies would have even more control over, or like what the leverage it would give these companies in terms of in their relationship with drivers and workers.
Before I let you go, I mean, as you know, California is often a testing ground for new policies. I mean, what do you think? Does this concept now spread to other states? I know you mentioned Uber and Lyft already have their eye on other places.
I think this is a huge blow, and I think, you know, it makes it a lot harder for people in other states to put up a fight against a model like this, just because it didn't work here from the perspective of labor advocates. So I think it does make it a lot tougher, but that doesn't mean, you know, things are set in stone. And another thing to consider is at the federal level, the Biden administration could rethink the way workers are classified at the federal level.
And we see a political committee called Illinoisans for Independent Work created last June. It was funded entirely by Lyft. So we'll see how this progresses across the country. LA Times business reporter Suhana Hussain, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.